This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss. If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, for several months, perhaps as long ago as a year, there have been difficult moments where racism has reared its very ugly head about the number of people who we have in this country who have migrated here. And more recently, there have been ugly scenes in the suburbs around the country also. In fact, last Saturday in Dublin, there was a very large march against racism, saying effectively that all were welcome in Ireland. But the rise of that right-wing stuff, anti-immigrant, racist, and thoroughly bigoted, is a concern for many people. And it's a pleasure now to welcome to the stand Professor Diarmaid Farrell. Diarmaid is Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD. And Diarmaid, I want to ask you this. I've always, you know, replied when contrasting Ireland with, say, England, where I lived, and other parts of Europe, in my own speciality subject of sport, there's the most vicious racism now all over Europe. Some of it is absolutely unbelievable, but it's there in England as well, as we see frequently terrible stuff that you would not see generally in Ireland. However, there have been rumblings. There are so many immigrants here now. And I wanted to ask you about the right, the far right, and the bigots in Irish society. And I had a look at the blue shirts, Ono Duffy, for example, who at least associated with fascists and probably was a fascist. Are we different from others in Europe and the British in terms of racism and bigotry? Or are we just, or have we just been fortunate so far?
There are a number of different ways you could look at that. You mentioned Owen O'Duffy there. O'Duffy was a fascist. O'Duffy was attracted by what was going on in Europe in the 1930s. And there was a lot of questioning during that decade about the value of democracy.
Yes.
And representative institutions. It was a wider European crisis, really. And we all know, of course, how it culminated in such a horrible way. But he was very attracted to the trappings of fascism, and what developed in Ireland with the blue shirts was the embracing of partly the cult of personality around O'Duffy, who was a mass of contradictions because his private life was completely at odds with the way in which he preached the gospel of national virility. He was an alcoholic, chain-smoking fascist who talked about the need for clean living and a disciplined army of people who would be pure in their aims and pure in their behaviour. So, you know, he was a mass.
He extolled the virtues of sport.
He did, very much, yeah. Yes. And he saw that as a way to discipline people, but also modelling, I suppose, some of his rhetoric on what was going on in Italy and Germany in relation to the purity of younger people and needing to get them into sporting organisations and needing to have them conform and salute. And, you know, to, of course, be involved in a program of national purity, which is about bringing out the best in them. And there's a hostility inherent in that to those who aren't deemed to be part of that. So there are elements of that. What it wasn't about, of course, was people coming into Ireland from elsewhere. And this is where Ireland is very, very interesting. And you mentioned there your experiences of England and Britain.
Yes.
Britain was dealing, obviously, with a wave of decolonization, particularly in the post-Second World War period, in the 50s, 60s and onwards. And, you know, you had a lot of people from former colonies coming to Britain. And that generated difficulties. It generated great opportunities as well, of course. But Ireland did not experience that. What we're talking about here, Eamon, is very, very new. Now, when you consider the very small number of people who came to Ireland, particularly in the 20th century, people might have heard of the Hungarian refugee crisis arising out of what was going on in Hungary in 1956. There were 500 of them, roughly, who came to Ireland, and they were badly treated. They ended up in a former army camp in Knocknalisheen in Limerick. They eventually went on strike because of the conditions in which they were being kept, and their rights under the UN Convention for refugees were not being respected in relation to them being allowed to work. And they eventually ended up going off to Canada, most of them. It was kind of a non-word migration, and Ireland wasn't used to dealing with that. But Ireland, of course, was also very harsh, and the Department of Justice was very harsh when it came to the Second World War and not admitting Jewish refugees. It was a very hard line taken in relation to that. And you also had, you know, at an even earlier stage, there was anti-Semitism, particularly in Limerick. You may have heard of the Limerick pogrom directed at the Jewish community in 1904. So, you know, there were incidents like that that suggested there was some kind of latent hostility to the idea of outsiders coming into Ireland. But it's not until the 1990s that it is actually experienced in a way that other European countries were experiencing it, because of Ireland's economic turnaround, because of the changes in Europe, because of the patterns of migration. And it was deemed to be extraordinary that by 2006, there were 420,000 non-nationals living in Ireland. And of course, that was going to grow and grow to the point where now it's in the region of 14% of the population in the Republic today are non-nationals. So that has been a huge transformation in a relatively short space of time. So what we're talking about today in the context of the protests and the growing manipulation, really, of I suppose what is a media ecosystem now, by those intent on whipping up racism and organizing the right in Ireland, that's a relatively new development. There isn't a long history of the right or the far right in Ireland. But you could argue, of course, that that was partly because there were so few non-natives here.
Yes. I mean, the question of race in sport, for example, here, we have some black players in the national soccer team now, and it's, I think it's fantastic. And the support for them in the Aviva is just amazing. I mean, the fans love the fact that we have these new Irish players now, while I call them new Irish, first generation Irish, or whatever. The contrast between our appreciation and respect for black players and what goes on in England, and there's a terrible case in Spain at the moment, there's a young Brazilian called Vinicius. He's a brilliant player. He's playing for Real Madrid, and there are monkey chants every time he touches the ball. And the most appalling racism, which is constant wherever he goes in Spain. It's really deeply shocking. And my own sort of superficial take, if you like, is that we don't have a racist newspaper. We don't have a racist political party, even though Eoghan O'Duffy was the first leader of Fine Gael, I understand. And we don't have tolerance for it. And I cite as evidence for that, that march last Saturday, there were about 10,000 people on it. And the banner said, everyone welcome, and sentiments such as that. It would be very, very hard to find that elsewhere in Europe now, but particularly in England, which I know very well.
Yeah. We have not been regarded as fertile ground to build far-right movements or racist movements for obvious reasons, because there wasn't deemed to be the potential there, partly because the numbers that you were talking about were small, but also because Ireland didn't necessarily experience what was happening in other parts of Europe, particularly over the last 40 or 50 years. When you look at the change in industrial society, you know, there was a time when you could locate a kind of a centre-left or a centre-right. You know, they were very well defined in opposition. And then the nature of industry and employment and the movement of people changed. And that did facilitate the rise of the right, built on the back of economic grievances and the breakdown of perhaps traditional class differentiations.
Yes.
And there's a real resentment towards the newcomer, towards the economic migrant. Obviously, the breakdown of economic barriers in Europe played a part in that. What Ireland had, I suppose, we didn't have those clearly defined differences to the same extent as other parts of Europe. We weren't doing particularly well economically, so it wasn't an attractive place. But you also have to broaden this out to consider that we have a very complex relationship with race and migration because of our own history.
Yes.
And I mean, the numbers are staggering. You know, in the last 300 years, between 9 and 10 million people have left this island. That's higher than the Irish population at its historic peak before the famine in the 1840s, when it was just over 8 million. That's the scale of the exodus that you're dealing with. So we were defined and are defined as a people by migration due to our history. Now, that led to a very complex mix, because it didn't mean that the Irish were not capable of racism. They certainly were. Irish people were victims of empire, but they were also participants in empire as a result of this massive exodus. And it's very interesting, for example, that Frederick Douglass, who was the best known black abolitionist in the United States in the middle of the 19th century, he was an escaped slave himself. He came to Ireland between 1845 and 1846, and he recorded his experiences of Ireland, where he was very well received. And he said to the Irish people, "I was not seen as a colour, I was seen as a man." And he shared platforms with Daniel O'Connell, who, of course, was the iconic nationalist leader at that time, who was very firm in his opposition to slavery. He was also very vain, because he introduced Frederick Douglass as the Black O'Connell of the United States. But he was making common cause with him. At the same time, there were other Irish nationalists and Republicans, like the Young Irelanders, who supported slavery. And there were, you know, those who had an economic interest in Ireland in slavery, including those operating out of Belfast, because it was a big business. When slavery was abolished in Britain in 1834, they had to compensate the slave owners. And it was an Irish man, James Blair from Newry, who received the biggest payout because of the amount of slaves that he owned. So we were stitched into the fabric of all that on that race question. But there was a sense that we could also make common cause, because there were times in the 19th century, and I'm using the contemporary language, where the Irish were referred to as the white Negroes.
Yes.
You know, we experienced our own racism in Britain, but then the Irish in America, many of them turned against the black population there. And Douglass was later to record that, you know, despite what he had written about the warmth of the reception he received in 1845 and 1846, he then went on later to say that none were worse than the Catholic Irish when it came to racism and displacing the native African Americans when it came to employment and so on. And the draft riots in New York in 1863, which were absolutely vicious. The context there was the American Civil War. The Irish were to the forefront in the lynching of the black population.
Yes.
And there were desperate things done then. So that's a part of our relationship with race over the centuries. And of course there was, and people will remember too, the appeals that were being made even recently in the 1980s about famine in Africa and understanding the plight of a people who were experiencing starvation and economic discrimination. And there was a huge emotional response from Irish people on the grounds that they could identify as a people who had been affected by famine and colonial exploitation. And you have that sense of empathy, but you also, of course, obviously have a tradition of Irish people being well capable of being involved in the excesses of exploitation and colonization. And that's a very complex legacy.
Yes, and I mean, the point you made there about the reputation Irish people had in America for being racist was something I was going to come to. And I suppose to talk about a country like Ireland having the virtue of being, you know, broad-minded and welcoming and not being racist, to a large extent, anti-Semitism, all forms of bigotry and prejudice, racism, they're all defined or generated, if you like, by circumstances. Isn't that the fact of the matter?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, when you go back to the original anti-Semitism I was talking about there, that was witnessed, say, in the early 20th century, that was about identifying Jewish people as treacherous, as being involved in economic exploitation, you know, all these tropes and stereotypes. Now, scholars would also maintain, though, that, you know, there were plenty of Jewish people who found a welcoming home in Ireland. Cormac O'Grada has written interestingly on the history of anti-Semitism in Ireland, and he maintains that it wasn't widespread. So it's not that they couldn't find some solace in Ireland. You can also, of course, make the point that, you know, in 2004, with the expansion of the EU, that Ireland was prepared to allow its borders stay open when it came to migration. There did seem to be something of a distinction, of course, between those who were coming from Europe and those who were coming from Africa. And that's another interesting aspect of this. But they were also needed. And you're talking about circumstances. So much of this, of course, is grounded in economics.
Yes.
And, you know, there were an awful lot of migrants, obviously, who were taking jobs that needed to be filled, that Irish people didn't necessarily want to fill. But we also have to remind ourselves of the asylum process. And, you know, I mean, there are 37 direct provision centres in Ireland at the last count, over 7,500 people. And many of them have been there for years, and one third of them are children. And that's another aspect of what became complicated from the late 1990s onwards. How do you manage this? You know, Foucault would have always made the point that, you know, the modern state cannot help but become racism in some form when it comes to the challenge of immigration and how you deal with, you know, processing this as an issue and how you administrate it and so on. And we had our own citizenship referendum here in 2004, you might recall, where the automatic birthright citizenship was taken away. And Ireland was unusual in maintaining that. And again, there were some who argued that it was appropriate that we had that given our own history. But it was also part of a new politics and new language around this question of how you deal with the amount of people who wanted to come into Ireland. But there was also a lot of exaggeration. The word flood was often used, for example, even though the statistics did not bear that out. And that's part of what we're talking about as well. How is this reported on? How is it discussed? There was a National Consultative Committee on Racism and Interculturalism that was established in 1998, but it was abolished in 2008 as a result of cutbacks. And, you know, the existence of that was a recognition that there needs to be discourse, there needs to be consultation. We can't assume that those who are expressing concerns about what is happening in their areas are all unthinking bigots and racists. Historically, migrants have ended up in areas that are already suffering from economic deprivation.
And that's part of the situation at the moment, isn't it?
It was the same when Irish people went abroad. You know, and even if you take that famine emigration and the racism that was exhibited towards Irish migrants, of course, they were competing with other poorer people. And, you know, so economic factors and where that integration process works, or if that integration process works, you know, that is around circumstances as well. But it's also about leadership. There was, before the 2002 election, an anti-racism protocol that was agreed by the main political parties, that this would not become an issue or a political issue. And, you know, support for far-right parties, according to the 2020 general election results, is minuscule. You're talking about in the region of 1%. But what's interesting at the moment is that Ireland is now being identified as suitable territory or fertile ground for those who want to manipulate this question. And there are those, obviously, who travel around and see opportunities and work social media in order to implant particular ideas or particular language. Isn't it interesting, you referenced some of the recent protests in Dublin, that the word plantation has been used.
Right.
Now, there's a deliberate grotesque misuse of Irish history. The idea that migrants are being planted to undermine traditional Irish identity and culture. This is a nativism that's built on the idea of a historical memory of how we were displaced.
Yeah.
And to compare what's happening today with the plantation of Munster and of Ulster, 3.5 million acres, a project of social engineering that was awesome in its scale, is obviously profoundly ahistorical and manipulative. But it just shows you how these rhythms work. You know, you begin to use a particular language or accusation, and then it builds traction or builds momentum.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The question of Fine Gael arises in my mind. I note, incidentally, that last week, a notorious British racist, a far-right character, Tommy Robinson, his ambitious piece of work. He's a working-class North of England guy who's been around this kind of stuff for a long time in Britain and is quite dangerous. He paid us a visit last week, and which is actually one of the triggers for asking you to talk to me today. If we're getting a character like that, and if he's thinking this may be fertile territory, then we do have potentially at least a problem. But I wanted to ask you about, I mean, the Fine Gael is a very interesting example to me. Ona Duffy was the first, the founder, I suppose, and they have had people, you know, in the 50s, 40s, 50s, 60s, even, who said pretty outrageous things in Dáil Éireann on the record, and yet it has evolved now into being, you know, a million miles away from that, as far as I can see, and it's been eradicated. There isn't anyone I can think of in Fine Gael right now, or any policy that they have put forward in the last 25, 30 years that I could think of as in any way bigoted, racist, or anything like that. So they have evolved out of it, haven't they?
Well, I mean, you mentioned there, Ona Duffy, there was also sometimes reference
Oliver Flanagan,
to Oliver
for
Flanagan. I mean, Oliver Flanagan, again, was an Irish manifestation of concern that was being expressed. This was the Monetary Reform Party in the 1940s. He actually came to prominence on the back of that before he became integrated into Fine Gael. And again, you know, he made blatantly anti-Semitic comments on the record. About, you know, Jewish conspiracy theories around money and credit control. This is about credit control. It's very much a product of the 1930s and the 1940s. And there wasn't much political road in that particular argument. It was of its time, and it certainly benefited him in the Midlands around that time. But there was no long-term traction in it. So what you're talking about there, I suppose, is, you know, what potential was there at various stages for the, you know, the politics of racism or for playing on that? You know, Ireland just remained a country that was not a favoured destination for migrants. So there was nothing there to be built out of an anti-immigration sentiment until relatively recently. And as you have said, there has, of course, been a reluctance in mainstream politics. There have been isolated incidents. You do get references, and there have been references at local level to the idea of, you know, housing the Irish first policy, and references to spongers and you know, money that's being supposedly hoarded or sent back. You know, there have been a few incidents like that, particularly at local level, but they've generally been strongly condemned by political leaders. But that also means that we have to be conscious of the integration challenge. I mean, it's all very well to talk about condemning those who are making incendiary or inaccurate or indeed racist remarks, but are there active integration policies? Is there going to be a reactivation of you know, a consultative forum on integration, on racism and interculturalism? Is there going to be that dialogue? Is there going to be dialogue with communities? That's where the challenges become much trickier.
Yes, and in direct provision, for example, people are only given €38 a week.
They are. And of course, and, I mean, it was found...
Not allowed to work.
It was found in 2017 that was unconstitutional, that they weren't allowed to work. But then they raised the bar so high that you had to be offered a job for €30,000 per annum, and you had to pay a fee in order for this to be activated. So, I mean, it was made impossible for many of them. And that's another issue around how we manage that, because, you know, we were different from other European countries in not allowing these applicants to work. So, you know, it's not about showering praise on Irish political leaders. Yes, you can acknowledge that they certainly have not been irresponsible when it comes to indulging in the opportunities that might be there to, you know, to make political hay out of this. But at the same time, you know, there has clearly been a lack of attention given to these issues of integration and to these much longer standing problems, because direct provision has been a system that has been excoriated for many years now. But it's not just colour-coded either, Eamon. I mean, you remember the 2018 general election when Peter Casey as a candidate went from minuscule support to getting over 23% of the vote, largely on the back of what he said about travellers. And they're another group who would maintain that they have been subjected to a very systematic racism over the years. So, you know, it's not necessarily just about those recent migrants who have come to the country in recent decades.
Just let me ask you two, in one question, about two factors that are obviously discernible wherever racism has flourished: the political parties and the media in countries like Britain and elsewhere too, giving, if you like, the oxygen of publicity to some of these foul ideas and notions. That's important, I think, in Ireland. But what I think doesn't really matter. When you observe it, Diarmaid, what do you think about the importance of a media that is absent that kind of stuff?
I think that's a very important point. And I think what you're saying is true, that we have a more responsible media. And we don't have that same history of a tabloid culture, of a frenzy. Now, there were criticisms made in the late 1990s about some of the language that was being used in reporting on the asylum question, on the wider immigration question, the kind of headlines or the kind of language that was being used. But it wasn't on the scale that you might get elsewhere, and that certainly was in evident.
But there were protests voiced, which in itself is something, you know, that is effective.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I mean, you're talking as well about people protesting about the way in which things were reported.
Yes.
You know, there was a response from that group I mentioned, the consultative group that had been set up. You know, they directly addressed the issue of media reporting, and they were calling out what they regarded as irresponsible and inaccurate reporting as well. Yes. Particularly when there's a reference to the idea of floods or you know, Ireland being overwhelmed by this and the degree of exaggeration that was going on. But you see, what media can also do, of course, and they do it regularly, is that they underline the plight of those who are making, you know, life-changing and often life-threatening journeys that are not of their choosing. You know, sometimes they are of their choosing, often they're not. And they would also underline the experiences that Irish people have with healthcare, for example.
Yes.
How many people who are being treated in Irish healthcare settings have been looked after by those from the Philippines or India who are working in healthcare settings? So, I mean, that's also about reporting in a much broader way the complexion of Irish society now, the complications around who we are and what we have become, but also the individual journeys that are involved in these migration stories. And a lot of those migrants themselves, whilst they have been vocal about some of the racism that they have experienced, many of them, of course, have also highlighted the great welcome that they have experienced. And again, you know, there are many different reasons for that. There is a strong sense of empathy and making common cause. You can see that in the Ukrainian
because of our history,
context as well. Yeah, I think part of it is our history, but you could never be complacent about that.
No, no.
Because it's quite clear, and again, this is why we have such a complex relationship with race, it's quite clear that there is always the capacity for things to turn nasty. I mentioned recently the work of the late Father Micheál MacGrail, who was a very interesting Jesuit priest and sociologist who wrote a book that caused quite a stir in the 1970s called Prejudice and Tolerance in Ireland. And he detected on the back of his research what he regarded as quite a dormant or latent racism. And of course, at that stage, there were only 11,000 non-nationals living in Ireland.
Yeah.
So, you know, it wasn't a societal issue, but he did make the interesting point, what will happen if we ever become a host society or if there are migrants coming to Ireland? And that's the question that he was raising. He went on to follow that book with subsequent books, you know, dealing with how things changed over the course of the 1980s, 1990s and beyond. And again, he found a lot of tolerance, but he was also able to identify prejudice. So it's that duality, you know, it's the prejudice and the tolerance. But for us, by and large, the tolerance has won out. The frightening thing at the moment, I suppose, is that there are those who now detect in Ireland an opportunity to push the prejudice.
And to send Tommy Robinson an invitation. Okay, Diarmaid, we're very, very grateful to you indeed for joining us today, Diarmaid. Ferriter is Professor of Modern Irish History in UCD, and he has a column always interesting in the Irish Times every Friday. We're grateful to Diarmaid, to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.